David Swanson is an author acclaimed by the likes of such great Americans and citizens of the world as former Marine and Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg, but he began as a journalist. Writing for small and medium-sized cities' newspapers was stifling him economically, and there was the oft-described conflict between personal morals and personal income. That is the U.S. journalist experience in a land in which key documents regarding the assassination of John F. Kennedy are still kept secret, in a land in which the Journalism Academy has been perverted with Pentagon dollars since right after World War II's end. Please see the citations in your program for more information on why David and other journalists found the U.S. newsroom a very strange place indeed. You can read about David Swanson's experiences at his personal website, Let's Try Democracy, and other blogs. He's quite prolific. Simply put, after doing day-to-day journalism, he found a better-paying job. More than doubling his income in Washington, D.C., writing newsletters for labor unions and businesses' human resources managers, he told them going in he would never say anything to harm a union, but that he would be fair. That wasn't good enough. They wanted him to draw blood and tell businesses how to beat those unions. David sought other work. He was Acorn's first and only director of communications before it was destroyed by Roger Ailes' Fox News. Then he went to work as press secretary for Dennis Kucinich for president. Kucinich, of course, was not elected president and returned to Congress. David went to work for peace groups. At one point, Senator Kucinich asked David to research articles of impeachment against George Bush II. David began researching, and along with a few other people, David helped produce 60 or 70 good articles of impeachment. From these, Senator Kucinich picked 35 he wanted to use on the floor of the Senate. It took hours to read them aloud. You can buy it in a book or find it on David's website, but David points out that within a year of President Obama taking the White House, David did return to those same articles and found that President Obama had also violated the majority of impeachment articles, as had Bush II. David says when he points this out, he is accused of being non-peaceful, but he's about to tell you nothing could be further from the truth. So I'm going to turn things over to the author of War is a Lie, the second edition. We ask you to listen to David Swanson's comments with an open mind and, more importantly, an open heart. And then during questions and answers, David Swanson says it's okay to question his authority. Please help us welcome David Swanson.
Thank you. Wonderful to be here. Great to see a new crowd. We just had an event with students and now presumably with largely non-students, but we can all try to be students for life. I'm trying my best to. Oneonta seems like a wonderful place. I went downtown and got lunch, and at the restaurant there was a wooden post that said, may peace prevail on earth in four different languages on the four sides. And I understand some of you are responsible for those. And it's a common sentiment. It would be nice to have peace on earth. It's also a common sentiment that we need to have wars. And if we're wise and reasonable and rational and not infantile and unreasonable and too idealistic, then we're going to have wars. I had a school board member where I live express his willingness to back a resolution celebrating the International Day of Peace, as long as we made very clear that in doing so, he wasn't opposing any wars. Now, this is something that doesn't happen with other evils. You know, we try to get peace through war. We don't try to get, you know, women's rights through rape or, you know, human rights through torture. It's only with war that we try to get peace with its opposite, using its opposite. There's this contradiction. And it's very hard for people, especially in this culture, I think, in the United States in particular, to see all the way around that and say, let's get peace through peace. And let's not use war at all in order to get peace, because we've been trying that for decades and it's proving counterproductive. And there actually is a better way. There was, how many of you have been hearing about this meeting last week at the Vatican about peace? A good number, not everybody. The Vatican hosted a number of peace advocates from dozens of countries around the world last week, hosted by the same cardinal who was the driving force behind the Pope's encyclical, the Pope's formal statement on the climate and the environment. But this meeting was about ending the pretense that there can be such a thing as a just war. I mean, this is 1,700 years of precedent, of harm, of legitimization of mass murder, and the Catholic Church is looking at undoing it and say, as a matter of fact, you can't have a just war any more than you can have just child abuse or just slavery. War is unjust, and from now on, this church is going to be in favor of a just peace. Well, now the thinking and the hope and the push is for the Pope to follow through on this meeting that was, you know, almost universal, overwhelmingly in support. And its final statement said, yes, let's do this. Let's put out this statement of new official church doctrine that we don't support war ever anymore. And so the Pope may soon release an encyclical opposing all war and saying anyone in the world, any Catholic, non-Catholic, should not participate in any war, should not participate in any weapons manufacture, which is part and parcel of war. This would be remarkable. And I say this as a non-Catholic and a non-Christian. I think the impact, the influence of people with this sort of prominence taking this position is dramatic. And while I think competition can be very much a part of the problem we're dealing with, I think the Unitarian Universalist Association should try to get in first before the Catholics and say, we condemn all war. We are opposed to all war. So I have this book about war from a particular angle, and that is the lies that are used to justify starting wars, the lies that are used to justify continuing, escalating, the lies that make wars look better after the fact. And the point of entry for most people into this today is Iraq 2003, because you had incredibly incompetent lying about starting a war. You had lies that were very easily and dramatically refuted. You had glaringly obvious intent on starting a war with lies, and those lies exposed and new lies presented, and by a Republican, so it wasn't acceptable the way it would be if, you know, with a Democrat. And this is where people come to with, you know, I had very smart people say to me, this hasn't happened since Vietnam, or this hasn't ever happened, a president lying about a war. And so I went and looked at every past war by the United States and many other countries, and I couldn't find one that hadn't been started and continued and beautified after the fact with very similar lies. You go back to the previous Iraq war, never mind the deadly sanctions that killed hundreds of thousands of children and adults, but the Gulf War. In the lead up to the Gulf War, you had Kuwait hire a public relations firm in Washington, D.C. to coach and prep the daughter of the ambassador to go and talk to Congress and pretend that the Iraqis had taken babies out of incubators in a hospital and thrown them on the floor to die. I mean, you had this whole pretense concocted that was nothing but a lie and used to start a war. And you know, dozens of others in that war and in the later Iraq war and in the previous. And when you start looking a little more deeply, you have to go back and say, well, why was the United States supporting this government in Iraq and arming this government in Iraq and keeping this dictator in Iraq in power that it now claims this urgent need to overthrow? And when you go back and look at the history of a particular country and question why now a dictator who's fallen out of good graces in Washington needs to be overthrown for humanitarian reasons, and you start looking at all the other dictatorships, even in that same region of the world where the United States is supporting and arming brutal governments right now, and you have to ask, why not stop supporting those rather than overthrowing this one? And you go back and look through the history of wars, and they all start to look very, very similar. Nobody, you know, really celebrates the War of 1812 very much anymore, though there was an anniversary a few years back now. But this was supposed to be a cakewalk. The Canadians were supposed to welcome the liberators with chocolates and flowers, and they didn't. They said, "What are you doing here? Get out of our country." As the Iraqis said so many years later, as the Canadians said on numerous occasions, not just 1812, but as everybody, as this country would say if it ever happened here, which everyone has this ongoing paranoia that it's about to, which, by the way, it isn't. You go back and look at the war that stole half of Mexico from Mexico. Mexico was willing to negotiate, was willing to sell half its country. The United States preferred to do it with war and preferred to start that war with a blatant lie about a Mexican invasion that was not a Mexican invasion. You go back and look at 1898 and a ship called the USS Maine blowing up in Havana Harbor. And Spain saying, "You want to accuse us of blowing up a ship? We had nothing to do with it. Let's take this to arbitration by a third country, an independent international panel. We will submit to any ruling. There's no need for a war over this." And the United States, in particular the newspapers in the United States that thought it was good for business and could bring the government along with them, said, "Oh, no, no, we want a war. We want a war." This was, you know, before the claim of last resort was really applied so prominently to every single war as it is now. Now, you know, war is always the first choice, but it has to be marketed as also a last resort. The Lusitania was a blatant lie before World War I that there weren't arms and troops on that ship. The Gulf of Tonkin incident that was used to get the war in Vietnam going, even though it didn't happen, and had it happened, it would have been a question of U.S. aggression in Vietnam, not Vietnamese aggression in the United States, and so on. So you go through all the list of bad wars, and very quickly, as has been going through your minds already, people start saying, "But what about the good wars? You're only talking about the bad wars. What about the good wars?" And we just had a conversation with a group of students here for the past couple hours, and they happened to pick the same good wars that have been picked in every room I've been in this country. And they were, of course, World War II and the Civil War and the U.S. Revolution and Rwanda. Rwanda may have moved into second place now. I mean, but World War II is overwhelmingly the justification for military spending in 2016 and 2017 and onward. It is overwhelmingly the top topic of U.S. entertainment and U.S. culture. It is our central myth of the top spending program in our government, World War II. And I think It's interesting that with nothing else do we go back 75 years to find a legitimate example of its use in order to justify it. I mean, if the education department had been making everybody more ignorant for 75 years, but it educated somebody in 1941, you know, would that justify hundreds of billions of dollars every year into the education department? Or if the Department of Transportation had been keeping people from leaving their houses for 75 years, but in 1941 it moved somebody down the street. Would that justify, you know, but with the biggest spending program, over half of discretionary spending by the Congress every year into militarism, into preparations for wars and also wars, you go back 75 years to find an instance to justify it. even though it was a completely different world, a world of colonialism and empire and no nuclear weapons and completely different systems of government and a world in which nobody knew the power of nonviolence. Nobody knew what nonviolence could do. And the women whose protests were so effective in the streets of Berlin won a victory and went home and didn't continue. And the nonviolent resistance to the Nazis in Eastern Europe and Scandinavia that was quite effective wasn't continued and expanded because people didn't understand what nonviolence can do, hadn't seen it as it's now been demonstrated to be a far more effective tool than violence, more successful at resisting tyranny and oppression and occupation than violence. Not guaranteed, but far more likely to succeed, and those successes far more likely to be lasting than when you use violence. And then there's always the problem of if you're going to go back 75 years to justify dumping my grandchildren's as yet to be earned pay into a criminal enterprise next year and the next year and the next year, why can't we go back 85 or 95 years? And say, why did we have to create World War II in the first place? I mean, why end World War I in a manner that wise people predicted on the spot was going to create World War II? Why do that? Why Wall Street fund Nazis for decades as preferable to communists? Why do that? Why can't we proceed with public policy from today forward that doesn't encourage an arms race and militarism and fascism that in fact works to avoid crises, and then when crises arise, settle them nonviolently with the support of the rule of law? You know, if the United States supported international law and international justice, that would be a huge step. Why not humanitarian aid? I mentioned this to the students, but I'll say it again. I read a few weeks ago an U.S. Air Force officer or expert of some sort who said, we have a system for dropping food from high elevation in high winds and landing it more accurately in Syria where people are starving to death and the UN can't drop food anywhere near them. They can't find the food. They continue starving to death. But this would cost $60,000 to use this technology, so we would never use it for a purely humanitarian operation. As a matter of principle, the U.S. government, what we all talk about as we in the first person, these are our priorities, as a matter of principle, would not spend $60,000 to save lives from starvation. Well, every single missile costs over $1 million each. Well, we are dumping about $1 trillion a year into militarism, right? Why not spend vastly less and make the United States loved rather than hated and encourage peace and stability rather than violence and chaos? But if you look at World War II, it doesn't look anything like the myths that are in all the movies and all the stories. For one thing, it had absolutely nothing to do with saving Jews or other victims in camps. There were peace activists who stressed that before and during the war and wanted the war ended to stop the killing and wanted negotiations to end it sooner. There were those who wanted Jewish refugees to be accepted somewhere in the world, even in this country. But the majority of Americans, to their eternal shame, did not. And their president did not. And his wife, contrary to other former presidents' wives who might be running for president's claim that they can't contradict their husband. Eleanor contradicted her husband all the time and said, let the Jewish children in, you know. But there were ships full of hundreds of Jewish refugees within sight of Miami, Florida, chased away by the Coast Guard, and hundreds of them killed by the Nazis. It had nothing to do with saving them until after the war was over. No steps were taken. And the millions who were killed in those camps were less than 10% of the millions killed in the war. Millions killed by the United States, millions killed by Germany outside the camps, more than inside the camps, millions killed by every country involved in the single worst thing ever to happen on this planet in any short space of time, World War II. And so to justify it as somehow necessary, and Roosevelt's lies and forged documents about Nazi plans to carve up South America and eliminate religion and innocent ships being attacked that were actually supporting British planes and all. You know, these were not lies necessary to trick the ignorant U.S. public into supporting something that was difficult but good. These were lies like the lies that get every war going. And, you know, this was not a defensive war. This was a war that Roosevelt had promised Churchill he was going to get in, that he did everything possible to provoke a Japanese attack for, and that night drafted a declaration of war against Japan and Germany. It was talked out of Germany. This was something that should have been avoided decades earlier, should have been avoided on the spot, should not have been escalated into the form that gave us all-out war on civilians. And the absolutely unjustifiable dropping of nuclear bombs on cities, to which President Obama is about to go and visit and not apologize, and possibly seek to justify, like John Kerry. I mean, this is absolutely inexcusable. And so to paint this moral picture of goodness in the United States, where we had an apartheid state for African Americans and Japanese Americans in camps and eugenics and human experimentation going before, during, and after that war, because the Nazis were evil, was not that the Nazis weren't evil. It's that the war had nothing to do with that. And if you wanted to stop supporting those evil programs, you could have done so in the 20s and the 30s, not just in that moment of crisis. So if you want to hear my rap on the Civil War or the Revolution or any other war, you know, tell me which war, and we'll do it. There's not a war that I don't think I can give you a good, at least a good plausible argument on. And even if I couldn't, you have to then make the case that justifies future wars. The other one that of course comes up now is ISIS. You know, if you don't want to have wars, do you want to just let them get away with it? Let them kill people? Right? I mean, again, while the United States is arming and funding governments like Saudi Arabia's that execute with knives in a similar manner far more people than ISIS, this particular enemy is supposed to be a problem. Never mind that it was created by the U.S. war in Iraq and the U.S. war in Syria and the proliferation of weapons from the overthrow in Libya and so on. Never mind that it put out videos begging the United States to attack it, and the United States attacked it and its recruitment soared. Never mind that top U.S. officials are retiring every year and then blurting out that it's counterproductive, that you're creating more enemies than you're killing. I mean, never mind that the weapons in the Middle East are primarily from the United States. And hatred and anger are always going to exist, but they're going to do a lot more damage when they are armed to the teeth. You know, this is a crisis that can be better handled by not continuing to make it worse, and by sending in humanitarian aid, and by negotiating disarmament, and by expanding a ceasefire into a real peace, and diplomatically resolving the situation, which is given lip service in the White House, but not serious attention. So once you start looking at every war in the way that I do, and maybe you're not all there yet, but when you cease to find any good ones, then you start asking, why don't we get rid of it? Why don't we abolish it? We have abolished or moved far down the line toward abolishing numerous evils that were once taken for granted as natural and inevitable and good, from slavery through dueling, through lynching, through family feuds and retribution against clans, the trials that used to be conducted by testing people for you know, God to determine whether they are innocent or guilty. I mean, all sorts of bizarre forms of violence and evil that have been accepted as absolutely normal and unquestionable. I mean, when the movement to abolish slavery grew up in England and in this country, most people on earth were slaves. And that had been the case for centuries. It was absolutely normal and natural and inevitable and justified by the Bible and so forth. And it was radically diminished and made immoral and illicit and illegal in a relatively short period of time. And it was not done by, you know, electing a slightly less disastrous candidate for president than some other one. It was done by building a moral movement, by educating people, by nonviolent resistance, by developing alternative forms of economics and livelihood. And it was done in most places without a war. I think if we start thinking in those terms, then we start looking at steps to get there. And if you wanted to talk about defense and cling to this idea of military defense, why not cut the United States Department of so-called defense back to something resembling other countries on earth? Why not, as Smedley Butler urged many years ago, restrict the U.S. military to within 200 miles of the U.S.? You would thereby eliminate 90% of so-called defense spending, which has no defensive purpose and is absolutely unheard of by any other country. Now, raise your hand if you can name the seven nations President Obama has bragged about bombing. Yeah, but you were here when we did this like an hour ago. There has never, ever before been a country that couldn't keep track of its wars. This is new. This is unprecedented. Never before has there been a public debate for the top office in a government where the candidates were asked on television, are you willing to kill thousands of innocent children as part of your basic responsibility as commander-in-chief? As presidential candidate was asked in a recent debate. I mean, this is unheard of. Doesn't happen anywhere else on earth and shouldn't. The idea that I came up with for this book then in War is a Lie was not to go through every single war, which would get, you know, endless, but to look at types of lies. So I look at the lies about war addressing evil. I look at the lies about war being defensive, the lies about war being humanitarian or philanthropic, which is a relatively new and popular one, but still much less effective than war is defensive. You know, you look at the lies around Libya, where we were told that Gaddafi is about to slaughter innocent civilians. And he wasn't. And you know, he's giving Viagra to his troops so they can rape more, which is just pure fabrication. I mean, all these lies, I mean, it's not Gaddafi was some kind of saint, but these were not true statements. They were lies. And then to go to the United Nations and get an authorization to protect the civilians from the non-existent threat, and then immediately start bombing the capital and overthrow the government and create chaos and proliferate weapons around the region and kill more people than Gaddafi ever could have killed, you know, that's not moral, legal, rational, defensible. You know, it had nothing to do. That's why when they said a similar thing about Syria, Russia and China said, oh no, you said that about Libya. Not this time. You know, why they fell for it on Libya, I don't understand, but they didn't go with it on Syria. Well, the United States is doing what it wants in Syria without the United Nations. It's better that it do it without the United Nations. It was better that we could oppose the war on Iraq as a crime for all these years rather than a humanitarian effort. The lies that were told about the chemical weapons in Syria in 2013, that the president had proof of who did it, which he did not. The lies that we've been told about who shot down an airplane in Ukraine and the endless reports of a Russian invasion of Ukraine. You know, Russia is invading Ukraine again. Like, I mean, if they already invaded, why again? And why next month? And why, you know, if there were a Russian invasion of Ukraine, we would know about it. There would be pictures. Right? It hasn't happened. The lies about the people on the mountaintop, where there was actually a grain of truth. There were people on the mountaintop. Some of them didn't want to be rescued. Some of them were rescued by Kurds. Some of them left of their own accord. But the bombing was almost all directed around where the oil was. And the U.S. personnel that supposedly had to be rescued, even though they all would have fit on a readily available airplane and could have been put on an airplane and flown out of there if it was about rescuing them. It wasn't. So, these humanitarian lies are dangerous because they appeal to people I know. They appeal to people who don't scream, "Let's kill all the Muslims." They appeal to people who say, "Let's have wars for good. Let's have humanitarian wars." And so they're damaging. So a number of us have tried to boost the movement for the total abolition of war. And we've started up an organization called World Beyond War with a website, worldbeyondwar.org, where we make the case that war kills mostly through the diversion of funds, not through any weapons. That for tens of billions, we could end starvation. We could provide clean drinking water. We could do incredible things for medicine and education and clean energy, where we're putting a trillion from the United States and another trillion from everybody else into a criminal enterprise. It's those trade-offs. Never mind that we could have all those nice things you see in Michael Moore's latest movie that other countries get to have, like education as a right and healthcare as a right and retirement and vacation and so forth, for far less money. We make the case that war is the top destroyer of the natural environment, that the U.S. military, the biggest consumer of petroleum on Earth, never mind that it fights so many wars over that petroleum, is the biggest destroyer of the environment, that it is the biggest destroyer of our civil liberties, the biggest promoter of racism in our culture, that it militarizes our local police, that it concentrates wealth, that it promotes violence and cruelty, and the nuclear danger, which did not go away and continues to grow. And President Obama is not just going to Hiroshima. He's going to Hiroshima while building more nuclear weapons that the U.S. government is talking about as being smaller and therefore more usable. More usable. I mean, you give an argument for that, but try to give an argument that's sane. Try to give an argument that's in any way reasonable at all for the idea that a nuclear weapon can be usable. I mean, this is madness. When people come to this topic and they haven't been there before, you know, they can get depressed, they can get sad that the U.S. government, doesn't just tell lies, but it does evil things, which is why it has to tell lies, because we aren't all evil, thank goodness. But we can also get encouraged and get happy that 96% of humanity is represented by governments putting dramatically less into militarism and war than the U.S. government. So it isn't actually the norm. When 4% of humanity does something this month, it's declared human nature, you know, as if the other 96% of humanity deviates from human nature and the United States defines it. But, you know, it's actually good news that at least 90% of humanity, you know, is funding and supporting war far less, and in many cases, not at all. And that even in this country, in the United States, 99% of the people have nothing to do with participating in war and don't want to. I mean, you can do a poll of the U.S. public and other publics around the world, different nations. Would you fight in a war for your country? You know, and in some countries, you get single digits. You get 10%, 20%. You know, you get the vast majority saying, no, I wouldn't fight in a war for my country. In the United States, I think the last I saw was 44% saying, I would fight in a war for my country. Well, what's stopping you? We got more wars than we can count. These are not people who actually want to fight in a war. They want to think of themselves as fighting in a war. It's acceptable in cultural terms for war to be happening, and they want to think of themselves as somehow participating, but they don't really want to. They don't really want to. There is not yet a single documented case in a hospital anywhere on earth of post-traumatic stress disorder from war deprivation. And the number one killer of U.S. troops is suicide. Is suicide. They come home and kill themselves. So the idea that it's natural or inevitable is just ridiculous and insulting. So a world beyond war is not some fantasy. It is a beautiful, far more humanitarian, sustainable, enjoyable place than what we've got now. and more different from what we've got now than we can possibly imagine. And once we get to no more war, we also get to no more arms trade. You know, as the Pope again told Congress, end the arms trade, and they cheered for him and continued the arms trade. The United States is the top armor of the world, and this is what produces the wars. That has to end. And when it ends, that benefits the U.S. economy as well as the U.S. morality and the U.N. the natural environment and everything else. I want to close with something that the great peacemaker who united the Iroquois nations said. Quote, "I and the Confederate lords now uproot the tallest pine tree, and into the cavity thereby made we cast all weapons of war. Into the depths of the earth, down into the deep underneath currents of water flowing into unknown regions, we cast all weapons of strife. We bury them from sight forever and plant again the tree. Thus shall all great peace be established, and hostilities shall no longer be known between the five nations, but only peace to a united people." Let's follow that example. It's nothing new, but we need to make it happen. I want to pass around a clipboard that's in the back of the room now that's from worldbeyondwar.org that has a very short statement, not unlike what I just read, that has been signed by people in 133 countries and growing. And we are planning a big conference in Washington, D.C. on alternatives to war in September that you'll find out about if you go to worldbeyondwar.org. And I would love to take any questions, and thank you for coming here. The case that my book tries to make is that anytime anyone is promoting a war, they are necessarily telling you lies, because a war cannot be justified, and that any claim of last resort is false because there always are other resorts. So when the public stopped the massive bombing of Syria in 2013 and reversed the president's decision to bomb Syria in 2013, there were all sorts of other alternatives that had always been available, including Syria giving up its chemical weapons, and there were alternatives that were not acted on, such as serious humanitarian aid and disarmament that should have been. When a war on Iran that was urgent and necessary was stopped in 2007 and in 2015 with a nuclear agreement and so forth, there are always alternatives. When the Taliban was willing to turn Osama bin Laden over to a third country to be put on trial, that was an alternative. War was preferable. When Saddam Hussein was willing to allow the U.S. military to search the entire country, was willing to leave the country, you know, these were all alternatives to bombing Baghdad. There are always alternatives, including simply not doing it. People will come up to you and say, "Oh, well, actually, there are better ways to do it now. I prefer drone wars because with drones, nobody gets killed." Right? Well, who counts as a somebody and who counts as a nobody? But the drone wars create the larger wars, and Obama has stopped calling Yemen a success story. And when somebody asks you, "Well, what's the alternative to drone wars?" you say, "Not murdering people with missiles from drones." That's the alternative. Because President Obama, who created drone wars effectively, I mean, this was very seldom used by George W. Bush. This was very much a Barack Obama creation. The legalization, so-called, and rationalization of murdering anybody, anywhere, anytime on Earth with missiles from robot airplanes. President Obama said, "Well, I'm going to impose," after, you know, a huge uproar and public discontent for years, he said, and lots of great protests up at Hancock near Syracuse that you should be participating in if you're not. President Obama said, "Well, I'm going to impose rules on myself, and then it'll be okay." And the rules are, never do it if you might kill a civilian. Only kill people who can't possibly be arrested. Only kill people who are an imminent and continuing threat to the United States, which, by the way, doesn't exist even in logic. If it's an imminent threat, it doesn't continue to be an imminent threat forever. And, you know, in not a single case that we know about, have any of these conditions been met. Most of the people aren't identified by name. None of them have been indicted. It's not, you know, law enforcement. Many, many of them, if not all of them, could quite easily have been arrested. I mean, we know of people who were, you know, next door to a police station and then went off to a rural area and were blown up with a missile. There's a man now in Europe asking to be taken off the lists, who they've tried to blow up four times in Pakistan, who's taken to sleeping outdoors so his wife and kids don't die with him. And he's gonna, if he goes back to Pakistan, he's likely to be killed there. And not a single one of these people has been an imminent threat to the United States. I mean, even in this propaganda film, Eye in the Sky, with Helen Mirren, where they've concocted this scenario where known, identified, named terrorists, who include a white woman, so it's not racist anymore, are in a neighborhood where they can't possibly be arrested and they're an imminent threat to kill other people. They're an imminent threat to kill other people, but not the United States. They're in Africa. You know, so, you know, never have Obama's self-imposed rules been met by Obama, and never has any legal authority questioned that or put a stop to it yet. That's going to be up to us. So I'm trying to restate what I think the question was, and I think it was that certain individuals, war profiteers, profit financially from war making, and will continue trying to do so until prevented. And you know, that's right, but it's a very limited idea of profit that's limited to finances. People who care about their children and grandchildren, as the CEOs of the weapons companies probably do, are contributing to a world that is at ever greater risk of nuclear holocaust, that is at ever greater risk of environmental destruction. The top destroyer of the environment is militarism, and the top destination of the funding that is needed for a radical attempt to rescue the natural environment is going into militarism. So in a little bit longer term, broader sense of benefits and costs, everybody is suffering, even the CEO of Lockheed Martin. Now, I think that that this culture needs to turn back the page a little bit to an era when war profiteering was shameful, back to the era of the 1930s even, and the Nye Committee, NYE, the Nye Committee in Congress that looked at the disastrous influence of the war profiteers in sabotaging disarmament conferences and promoting wars and pushing the United States into World War I, and said, let's at least nationalize it. Let's at least take the private corporations and the private profiteering out of war. I mean, which is, you know, one of those dramatic steps that you're only going to get when you get to a culture that's ready to end war. Just like proposals to have a public referendum before you can go to war, which almost passed in the 30s as well, or to put the children of top officials on the front line and all that. I mean, these are all ideas that will happen only when we're ready to end war. But I think that we have to start pushing divestment campaigns from weapons makers, not just Israeli weapons makers, which is wonderful, but U.S. weapons makers too. We have to insist on boycotts and divestments and sanctions against U.S. war profiteers, just as Israeli war profiteers or any other war profiteers. And when you have a system where Secretary of State Clinton can take over $10 million from Saudi Arabia, well, right before she became Secretary of State, and then while Secretary of State take $900,000 from Boeing, and then make it her crusade to push through the sale of the Boeing airplanes to Saudi Arabia that are now blowing up men, women, and children. And that's treated as normal business. And you can go through the list of the nasty governments that put millions into the Clinton Foundation, the Clinton Family Foundation, and then Hillary Clinton waived the restrictions on selling weapons to those countries. When you have that level of corruption of public officials, they have to be shamed, and they should not be allowed to run for president, for God's sake. You know, and there's legislation now that if it passes through Congress and is signed, would end weapon sales to Saudi Arabia. That's great. But there are already laws that forbid that. And we have to hold accountable, you know, the people who have made it their mission to get those weapons over there. And President Obama has just gone over there and shaken hands and said, more weapons are coming. We're getting them to you as fast as we can. You know, but we're bombing Syria and Iraq so fast we're running out of bombs and missiles. We're having trouble making enough. So, you know, patience. That sort of counterproductive madness has to end. First of all, to take nothing away from Denis Kucinich, who is a wonderful human being. He was never a senator. He was a representative in the House of Representatives, which is where impeachment happens. In the Senate, you have a trial, which comes after impeachment. And he was taken out of the House of Representatives by war profiteering money given to a challenger after the Republicans in Ohio put his district and another Democrat's district together. Otherwise, he would still be there and would be the best supporter of peace in Congress. And he will be speaking at this conference in September in Washington, D.C. that I mentioned. Canada, I've heard, I don't know much about the details and haven't been, you know, intimately involved, but Canada, I understand, has an active progressing movement to create a Department of Peace. And I think it would be wonderful if it did. Canada has helped push other nations, not this one, but most nations, on other things like banning landmines and so forth that have been very helpful, not to hold Canada up as a model of perfection. The Department of Peace has been in the U.S. conversation since people like Benjamin Rush, who signed the Declaration of Independence and pushed for a Department of Peace. It's not a brand new idea. And there was a big push for it back in the 80s in a slightly different form that was for an Academy of Peace to go up against the military academies and schools in D.C. and elsewhere. And as it started to develop and go through Congress and get modified and amended, it became clear to many people that it was going to be a front for war. It was going to be an Orwellian institution to continue waging war under the banner of peace. And it was created under the name U.S. Institute of Peace. And it now has this massive new building next to the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. that has supposedly a dove, possibly a brassiere, but something on top of it that looks very odd. And carved into the stone as a funder and supporter, Lockheed Martin and all the other, you know, biggest weapons makers. And a number of us created a big petition last year to the U.S. Institute of Peace asking them to pick a war, any war, and oppose it, you know, because they have never opposed a war, and stop promoting wars, because they, you know, they backed the Iran nuclear agreement, which was great. They've been pushing for bigger wars and overthrows of the government in Syria for years now, and going up to Congress and testifying. And it says on C-SPAN, so-and-so from U.S. Institute of Peace, and out of their mouth is coming, let's have another overthrow of another government, this time in Syria. And so we took this petition and we sat down with them for an hour or two and met with their president and board members and so forth and said, can you be for peace? You know, it's your name. And they effectively said, no, we cannot. And I said, can you be for peace in Afghanistan? Can you oppose war in Afghanistan? And the president of the U.S. Institute for Peace said to me, we are in favor ultimately of getting to peace in Afghanistan. And I said, well, is the path you see to peace in Afghanistan through war? And she said, well, can you define war, please? I said, yeah, this is where they're coming from. And so to create another institution with peace in its name, it's not that it would be a bad thing. It's that unless we make it actually for peace and empowered to actually advocate for peace and the details of who's on its board and who it answers to and how it's structured actually be for peace, you know, and if we did that, you know, we could do that to the State Department. The State Department doesn't have to be a marketing firm for gas companies and weapons makers. The State Department could be an advocate for peace to counter the War Department that's now called the Defense Department. But it's going to take cultural change, nonviolent movement building, momentum creation. It's going to take countering or reforming the corruption that pervades the system. And whether creating a new department is part of that or not, you know, is a more minor question, I think. The United States culture has in recent years and even months become ever more obsessed with elections, which, as Emma Goldman said, if elections ever changed anything, they would ban them. They are not fundamentally the way to change. They are a small part of how you change things, and it would be good if we had a fair and open and verifiable election in the United States. We do not. We need incredible reforms in order to have a fair and open and transparent and verifiable election. But women didn't vote themselves the right to vote. Change has never come primarily through that means, and it's a very new and very bizarre idea that the most important thing we can do is vote and back candidates, and it is an incredible drain and distraction from policy-based, nonviolent activism using the 1,001 tools of nonviolence for change. I look in my book not just at the stories we're told to support wars, which all turn out to usually be false, but also at real motivations. And I think there are many, including greed, including electoral political calculations, including profits and corruption, and including irrational desires to dominate the planet. So that when the Cold War ended and people said, oh, we're going to have a peace dividend and we're going to stop having so many wars, no, the desire to dominate the earth didn't end. The wars rolled right on, as they will continue to do until that desire is taken away. But I look at examples in my book of internal discussions in the U.S. government of why should we have this war? The Vietnam War, officials in the White House discussing, we're going to continue the war. Let's come up with a good reason why. And then a totally second step, let's come up with a good reason to tell the public. You know, like Wolfowitz, we came up with weapons of mass destruction because we could get the most agreement around that one, and that's the one we said. You know, the reasons are concocted, and the real reasons certainly include greed, but without acceptance and apathy, greed would get nowhere. You know, without the hundreds of millions of people saying, oh, okay, or telling pollsters yes, or waving flags, or putting yellow ribbons on their SUVs, you know, greed would get nowhere. You know, it's a handful of people can't determine the policy of hundreds of millions of people unless those hundreds of millions of people go along, right? So, you know, it's not evil that destroys the world. It's obedience. You know, it's acceptance. And we have to start resisting, and it would take a relatively small number of people resisting to change everything. The question is, how do we transition from a military bureaucracy in the Pentagon and elsewhere that sees its existence and paychecks coming from militarism to a different structure where those people could lose their jobs? And you know, the military spending employs people not primarily in the Pentagon. I mean, the Pentagon is a teeny fraction of it, but millions of people in the military in 175 other countries that they admit to, and where they thank the troops for watching the Super Bowl and everybody, you know, goes along with it. And the weapons companies and the war profiteers and their subcontractors is a huge chunk of the U.S. industry that gets its funding from the military, a big and growing chunk of U.S. academia. I mean, it's everywhere. I mean, you can't find a store on this street, probably, unless it's a principled and exclusively local non-chain store that isn't a military contractor. If you want to transition, there is more than enough money there to retrain and retool so that nobody, other than that very small number of CEOs that we mentioned earlier, has to suffer at all. I mean, and there have been proposals to do this four decades. The Columbia University professor, Seymour Melman, who used to work on this and write books on this for years and years, there was a bill in Congress that was doing very well toward passage when President Kennedy was killed and then wasn't heard of. There was a bill making its way for a peace dividend and transition when the Cold War ended that was really blocked by Congressman Newt Gingrich from Lockheed Martin, Georgia. And there are proposals that would make this happen in detail that have been around for decades. It's not hard to do. And you know, there are small bills that get no attention, like Congresswoman, or not really Congresswoman, Eleanor Holmes Norton from DC, who always introduces a bill to get rid of nuclear weapons and put the money into good things. But there was actually a fear generated a few years ago that military spending in Washington, DC was going to be slashed. And there was no indication that was real, and it wasn't happening, and it hasn't happened. And the Department of so-called Defense has gotten more money under President Obama than any previous president. The military spending has continued to increase, and it's, you know, still 80-90% above where it was on September 11th, 2001. But there was this fear created that military spending is going to be hacked. And so you actually had some places like the state of Connecticut create a commission to start studying how do we transition to peaceful industries for economic reasons alone, with labor unions and environmental groups and industry management on the commission. And they started looking at it and started looking at it, and I haven't heard much from these lately, possibly because nobody thinks military spending is getting cut anymore. So if we could, it's chicken and egg. Do we first create the transition or do we create the cuts to military spending? But at the local level, you can go to your local government and say, there is money in Washington, D.C. for transition to peaceful industries. There is a scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies named Miriam Pemberton who works on this all the time. You can contact her and get her help and go to your city council and say, I'm not here to ask for money like everybody else. I'm here to propose money you can have. And all you got to do is something that's beneficial in all these endless ways. You don't even have to mention that it's beneficial to not murdering masses of human beings if that's too controversial. But it's beneficial economically, it's beneficial environmentally, etc. And start working at the local level to transition and start building education and awareness about transition to peaceful industries. And it's not as if it hasn't been done, you know, and the U.S. military is, you know, right now looking at closing a number of bases in the United States because it likes other bases more. It's not like it's shrinking, it's just closing certain bases, but Congress won't do it. Congress won't do it, so they're, you know, the military said, well, we're going to close them without you, you know. And we need to be pushing for when those bases close to turn, you know, there's a guy up in Buffalo has a great proposal for closing a base and turning it into a solar energy array. You know, we need to change these places into useful things and hold them up as examples, you know, instead of this base. You know, the people of Okinawa have just stopped for the moment, another big U.S. military base. They need to be applauded, supported. We need to be in telling Washington we're with them, and we want to close all the other ones in Okinawa, and here's what we want to turn them into, you know. And you know, we need some more of those examples to hold up. So the question was, how can we discuss controversial subjects in public schools where that seems to be forbidden, which, you know, is not universally forbidden, but much too much, and obviously shouldn't be. What should people be learning in public school other than how to discuss and debate controversial subjects? I think it's far more important than particular bits of knowledge that can be put into their brains. And, you know, there are wonderful organizations doing counter-recruitment work, going into the cafeterias next to the military recruiters with veterans saying, here's what war is really like. There are organizations working on getting better textbooks into schools, on getting the military recruitment exams out of schools. Then there are people who have found a way to go in and talk to high school classes, which is something I'm really trying to work on because I've been talking more to college students, which is great, but high school students need to hear things too. It's just like this member of the school board that I mentioned that wants to be for peace as long as he doesn't have to be against any wars. We need to make that be laughable as it is. We need to make that be reprehensible, and we need a culture where we overcome this Fox News, MSNBC idea that we should yell and scream at each other, and instead figure out how we can have events where we talk to each other, where we have, why not have a couple of speakers who don't agree? And don't call it a debate, call it multiple points of view and have them discuss things from multiple points of view, which opens students up to thinking, God forbid. So it's a work in progress. Eugene Victor Debs said, "I don't want you to follow me into the revolution, because if you would follow me, you would follow somebody else too. I want you to do it. I want you all to lead yourselves to where we need to get." And that's what we need politically in terms of activism. And it's how you convince people. If you go up to people and you yell at them and tell them they must obey what you have to say, it doesn't work any more than bombing people makes them love you, any more than fornicating creates virgins. It doesn't work. I agree with you. And I think we need independent thinking, and that's what our schools should be teaching primarily, is independent thinking, starting with skepticism toward anything that comes out of that box called the television, which you'd be better off without, frankly.